Schwarz und Weiß.
Hello and welcome to this edition of Majlisa Weekly Podcast, where we discuss some of the pressing issues of the day involving Central Asia. In this edition, we will discuss what Japan is up to in Central Asia. I raise this question in light of landmark visit by the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe this week, in which contracts worth $26 billion was signed. It's huge money. Why is this? Is this a sign of a new Japanese policy that places more interest on ties with Central Asia? What did Abe's trip accomplish? More importantly, what about the timing, considering the visit came at a time when Central Asia's two primary bankers, Russia and China, are experiencing their own economic problems? Also, how these Japanese efforts meet dynamics in Central Asia. To discuss the subject, I have Jack Farchi, Financial Times reporter from Moscow. Jack, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
From Tokyo, Dr. Timur Dedabayev, lecturer at the University of Tsukuba of Japan, who closely follow Japanese foreign policy towards Central Asia. Dr. Timur, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
As always, I have the pleasure of having my colleague Bruce Panier, who is in the studio with me here in Prague. He is the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog called Kishlak Awazi. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I am Mohammed Tahir, director of the Turkmen Service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. So let me start with Dr. Dedabayev with you. Why Abe was in Central Asia, visiting all Central Asian countries, throwing lots of money? Is this a sign of a shift in Japanese foreign policy towards Central Asia?
Well, this is not really the first time the Japanese Prime Minister visits this region. Actually, the first time the Japanese Prime Minister visited Central Asia was in 2006 when Prime Minister Koizumi visited Central Asia. But actually, this is the first time when Prime Minister of Japan visits all five countries of Central Asia. And that is something that needs to be emphasized, and probably that makes this visit, particularly, something of a historical sort of, meaning. But I think the goal of the Japanese Prime Minister's visit can be considered, along the lines of four main objectives that he had. And firstly, it is basically to strengthen the Japanese business community's standing in Central Asia. And that in particular was obvious in Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Kazakhstan this time. Secondly, it was to secure the orders of Central Asian countries for the Japanese countries, for Japanese corporations back at home. And that was the example. The very good example would be the attempt to build the nuclear plant in Kazakhstan. And the third would be probably the third objective would be to build this soft power of Japan in the region by launching this centers and university in Turkmenistan, which is going to be functioning based on the Japanese model. And the fourth reason would be to extend the humanitarian assistance that Japan has been extending for over a period of 24 years of the independence of these countries. And Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan probably are the best examples for that.
Thank you, Dr. Dedabayev. Jack, you have a different opinion about reasoning behind Japanese Prime Minister's visit to Central Asia. In your recent Financial Times article on Abe's visit, your biggest argument was to curb increasing Chinese influence in the region. Why you think so?
Yeah, I think that's right. I would put the visit very much in the context of China's new Silk Road policy that was first announced a couple of years ago, but that has really been gathering steam this year with the launch of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, which notably Japan has not joined. I'm a Central Asia correspondent, so I'm not an expert on Japan, but from speaking to my Tokyo correspondents and also to experts in the region, it's clear that Japan is very concerned about China's push, not only in Central Asia, but also in Southeast Asia. Japanese companies have been beginning to miss out on deals to Chinese companies. So the most notable one recently was Indonesia's decision to choose Chinese companies to build its high-speed rail line, which Japanese industry had hoped to secure for themselves. So it seems to me that what's happening is Japan has noticed that China is putting a massive policy push into infrastructure in the whole region, and that they fear that if China is prepared to spend a lot of money here, that will also open the door to Chinese companies and contractors to win all of the contracts, which typically Japan has seen as its speciality, these kind of infrastructure, technology, services contracts. And so now we're seeing a political push to try and reverse that.
Bruce, we have two different opinions about Abe's visit to Central Asia. What's your take and what's expressed, and what's your opinion in general about this trip?
Well, I think that Japan certainly wanted to raise its profile in Central Asia, and we have to remember, certainly as concerns competition with China, that Japan was there well before there was much Chinese influence in the region. So I think that this was an effort by the Japanese government to push themselves back into the spotlight to some extent. Certainly the amount of money that they were talking about far exceeds anything that they had invested in previously. You know, as I said, and as Dr. Dadabayev said too, that, you know, Japan has been there for many, many years, 20 years, but they've always had a very low profile. Before soft power was a term, Japanese were practicing soft power in Central Asia. There was a lot of projects that they engaged in and still do engage in that have to do with water purification, building of schools, healthcare, agriculture, things like that. They're you know, $1 million here, $5 million there, but it's been consistent for about some 20 years. So I think that they thought that maybe now that was the time to make a big push, to get themselves some headlines in local press, world press, for a trip through Japan, and show everybody, particularly the Central Asians, that they were and can be a substantial player in the Central Asian region.
Right. Dr. Dadabayev, you mostly concentrated on the economic aspect of this visit, and Jack, you also touched upon some political issues. So let's talk about what exactly interests Japan in political field, for example, or the economic sphere. I know in Turkmenistan, which attracted most of the $26 billion contract, the discussion was centered on the energy aspect. So Dr. Dadabayev, for example, what is that Japan want in terms of economy in Central Asia?
Yeah, I think it's quite obvious that, you know, the primary objective of Japanese involvement in Central Asia lies more in an economic field rather than in political one. And if you talk to, you know, practitioners from the Foreign Ministry of Japan or, you know, the scholars, there are very few actually people who directly connect Japanese initiative in Central Asia to an attempt to, you know, compete with the Chinese, Russian, or Korean sort of interest there. And if you look at the focus of the initiatives and, you know, the list of the documents signed during the visit, it is quite obvious that, you know, economy actually dominates the agenda for the Japanese foreign policy engagement in Central Asia. In terms, but that wouldn't imply that, you know, Japan doesn't, notice the steps which are taken by China or Russia in that region. What is quite obvious that, you know, that, efforts by China, Russia, and Korea in Central Asia add up to the motivations for the Japanese to get involved more actively in the region. But this, Chinese, Russian, or Korean influences are not the primary motivation for Japan to get involved in this region. And in terms of political sort of engagement, I would emphasize one point about the stimulation and encouragement of regional integration. Japan, for the number of years, emphasized that it is willing to finance the projects which would involve two or more Central Asian countries in the implementation. And that can be indirectly linked to the strengthening of Central Asian capacity to negotiate with the bigger powers like Russia and China. But again, that has this primary focus on enforcing and encouraging regional countries to strengthen their own capacity to deal with regional problems, as opposed to directly sort of compete with China or Russia, for that matter.
Jack, I want to give you a microphone here. And you heard what the Dr. Dadayev has said. So what makes you think that, there is politics involved in this visit?
I'm not sure we have such a big disagreement, in fact. I mean, I would see a lot of both Japan's involvement and China's involvement from an economic point of view. I think the politics for Japan is about being concerned that Japanese industry will lose out on business because China is launching this big new Silk Road economic push. And if that means that Chinese companies are going to win more contracts in areas that Japan has typically dominated, like infrastructure, nuclear, that kind of thing, then that's obviously a big concern for Japanese industry. So I don't think Japan wants to become a new political force in Central Asia, like, say, Russia is. I'm not sure China really wants that role either. I think it's much more about business and about economics.
Yeah, I actually have something, a follow-up, and I'd like to ask both our guests to comment on this, too. In 1999, I was down in Batken. At the time, the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan had entered southern Kyrgyzstan and captured four Japanese geologists. When I was down there, there was Japanese correspondence, because, of course, they let them in to cover the story. And I remember that one of the correspondents from Asahi Shimbun told me that... it was only his opinion, but he said Japan looks at Central Asia as an area where maybe they could have some kind of influence. Now, of course, this predates the Chinese entry into Central Asia, certainly. But we've been talking about the economics of Japanese involvement in Central Asia. But do either of you feel that there is actually a perception in Tokyo, in Japan, that this is an area that's still open to... influence from outside powers, and that this is an area where Japan sees that they might be able to get some advantage in the future, or at least have some say in how the economic resources are being moved, some kind of influence in the region. We'll start with Dr. Dadabayev.
Actually, I second this opinion that perhaps, Japan sees more, in terms of opportunities which go beyond this economic and political influence, and that I would probably connect that to something that we call these days soft power, and that is the public perception of Japan. In recent, actually, poll which the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Japan conducted in April of this year, before the visit actually happened, they polled all five Central Asian countries in terms of the attitude of population towards the different countries, and Japan actually ranked very high in terms of the favorable sort of image that Japan has, and that actually adds up to the trust with which Japan can operate at the economical level. So I would probably argue that Central Asia is one of these rare regions in Asia where there is no sort of history of the Japanese imperialism. And that actually makes Central Asia more sort of accessible for Japan. And, which is quite obvious is that, public perception of Japan is very favorable. And, there are actually constant voices for calling for Japanese, more active involvement in this region. And it is Japan which lags behind in terms of its initiatives and, engagement in that part of the world.
Yeah, I totally agree with the Japanese perception in that region. But the what to say about the perception of some of the traditional regional brokers about Japanese activities, let's say increasing activities in Central Asia. And Moscow always considered Central Asia as its backyard. And how the Russians are reading what's happening in terms of increasing Japanese activities there?
I don't think any of the regional brokers will be deeply concerned thus far. I mean, we've seen all these deals signed, but many of them seem to be some way from being final contracts. I think a key test will come with the first Kazakh nuclear power station, if it actually ever gets built, whether it will be a Japanese company, a Chinese company, a Russian company, or some other company who gets to build it. That will be an area where I'm sure Rosatom will have a lot of interest in building that. As we see, the Japanese are keen, and I think there's some Chinese interest as well. So that's one area where we will have a clear sign of whether Japan's economic business push into the region can bear some more fruit, or whether traditional power brokers in the region will be able to leverage their other means of influence to secure that business for them, for their own company.
Right. Bruce, you had a point to raise here. If not, my other question would be, is this a coincidence that the trip of Abe just came a few days ahead of U.S. Secretary of State's visit to Central Asia? How to read that from that point of view?
This is certainly something I've been considering for a while. There's, it's too much of a coincidence to believe that Abe's visit just happened to come right before Secretary of State Kerry. Now, we knew, and Jack will probably remember from a month ago when we were in Bishkek, that there was already word out that Kerry was coming. So the Japanese Prime Minister's visit would have been planned well in advance, but not so much in advance that they couldn't have consulted with the U.S. So I do think it's kind of significant that we have the Japanese Prime Minister coming to Central Asia, followed by the U.S. Secretary of State. I'm not sure what the discussions were about, but it seems to me that there must have been some coordination involved in these two trips. And just to follow that up a little bit, I do think that this is, for both China and Russia, this is a moment where they're financially weak. They're not able to project their influence in the manner they have in previous years. So this, if it is a coordinated move, it would make sense to do it now, because this is the prime time to get into Central Asia and bring a different message at a time when, for temporarily at least, the Russian and Chinese voices are somewhat muted in the region.
Right. Japan certainly has its own interest in the region, and we also have to look from the Central Asian perspectives what they get from this increasing Japanese activities in the region. So I would like to take a short break here. When we come back, we will look into Abe's visit from Central Asian perspective. Welcome back to the Majlisa podcast, in which we discuss today's pressing matters involving Central Asia. And today we are talking about the increasing role of Japan in the region. In the studio with me is Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog called Kishlak Awazi. On the line from Moscow, I have Jack Farchi, Financial Times reporter. And from Tokyo, Dr. Temur Dadabayev, lecturer at the University of Tsukuba of Japan, who closely follow Japanese foreign policy towards Central Asia. Yes, we in the first part we discussed about the lots of competing interests involving superpowers, regional superpowers in Central Asia. So let's look at from the Central Asian perspective. Can Central Asia afford to be in this competition? You know, most of them are in debt, for example, to China from head to toe. Jack, this was your argument in your recent piece to Central Asia.
I mean, I think from the Central Asian perspective, Central Asian countries and leaders and elites love as much competition for their attention as they can drum up, because the more competition, the more likely they are to get better terms for whatever deals there are on the table, and to be able to extract both their own countries and potentially for themselves and for their own elite. So from a Central Asian perspective, I'm sure they welcome both the fact that Abe is on tour in Central Asia and is making a big point of coming and talking about Japanese investment in the region, and also that now they have Kerry coming, and certainly if that makes some people in Moscow and Beijing think, gosh, we need to really make sure that we're securing our position in the region, then I'm sure the Central Asian elites will be very happy about it. If it gives them another negotiating point and a position from which they can have some negotiation with either Chinese or Russian or other partners, then obviously for them that is very welcome.
Bruce, as Jack say, Central Asians welcome this kind of competition. And first, what is your opinion on that? And the second is, if it does, what kind of risks involve in this from the Central Asian perspective?
Well, first, of course, I agree with Jack 100% that the more partners that are, the more people that the Central Asians are dealing with, the more leverage they're going to have at bargaining tables when they go to speak with other partners.
But it's not risk-free.
It's not risk-free, that's true. But I would, obviously anytime the Central Asians are speaking to the United States or India or some of these other countries who haven't been kind of peripheral partners, I suppose, is the best way to put it. You know, they run the risk that they're gonna anger either Beijing or Moscow. You know, on the other hand, as Jack rightly mentioned, there's a chance that they might attract the attention of Moscow and Beijing in a way they would find more positively, meaning that both those capitals would say we have to up our game in Central Asia and spend more money out there. You know, there's going to be a few hurt feelings because the contracts that the Japanese are talking about signing are contracts that others in China and Russia would wish for themselves. So this could be problematic. And not that I think Kazakhstan will sign not that I don't think they'll even build a nuclear power plant anytime soon. But if they did choose a Japanese partner, then certainly you could expect that Rosatom would be put out, and there would be some repercussions in Kazakhstan, Kazakh-Russian relations as concerns the nuclear power industry. That said, when I look at the Turkmen contracts, for instance, they're actually kind of complementary to what certainly China is doing in some ways. I mean, they want the synthetic fuels and things probably work against China, but as far as gas compressor stations and improving the technology to get gas out of the ground in Galkanish and get it cleaned up and ready for shipping, that does benefit China to some extent. So if the Japanese are willing to spend the money on building the facilities for projects like that, ultimately China benefits from it too. So there really wouldn't be too much of a backlash, I would think. You know, of course, Chinese companies or Russian companies would have appreciated those contracts too. But as far as China's concerned, they'll still get the gas; it'll still be clean. You know, and they don't have to spend the money on it in the end. So I guess they get the clean product that they can use without having to spend more money than the huge amount they already have in developing the Galkanish field, for example.
Right, Dr. Dudabaev. First of all, what you think about what has been already said? And the second, what Central Asians are getting out of these deals or the recent visit by the Japanese Prime Minister?
Well, it is my impression that, you know, the talk about the, you know, competition in Central Asia for, you know, regional or, you know, global competition in Central Asia is really over exaggerated. Because if you look at the, you know, areas that each of these countries actually focus, they do not overlap too much. And I think, you know, this is what Bruce was saying, and, you know, he was implying that, you know, Chinese can use the Japanese sort of, you know, infrastructure development projects for their own benefit. And, you know, actually the same goes about the Japanese, because in Kazakhstan, you know, when they've made this, you know, common sort of declaration, you know, both, you know, Nazarbayev and, you know, Abe, they emphasized that, you know, they welcome any kind of infrastructure development because that would eventually lead to the, you know, increasing of export potential for Central Asians. And, you know, obviously for Japan, this is a very big, you know, issue because Japan doesn't share any, you know, borders with these countries. Japan doesn't have any transportation infrastructure that would lead to Central Asia without crossing, you know, so-called unfriendly states, you know. And, you know, in order for Japan to import, you know, any resources, you know, it would either need to go through China, Korea, or Russia. And these countries are not exactly, you know, friendly countries to Japan. So for Japan, you know, Chinese initiative of, you know, building this, you know, so-called Silk Road and getting the, you know, access for Central Asians to the, you know, seas, and that actually benefits Japanese much more than, you know, any other possible sort of initiative that, you know, might be taking place. And so, you know, I believe that, you know, this competition talk is really an imposed sort of concept, you know, and I think, you know, probably it comes from the sort of type of thinking when we, you know, when many, you know, specialists believe that, you know, countries should compete and they cannot cooperate. And I think, you know, Central Asia is one place where, you know, interests can be compatible, which we can actually see in the case of Japan and other countries. And in terms of what Central Asians get, you know, I think, you know, it's quite obvious, you know, they, you know, I mean, the infrastructure and humanitarian aid and human development, all of these issues are very important. But I think, you know, another aspect that hasn't been untouched is that, you know, the model of development which Japan offers is a bit different from the Western, you know, type of development. But at the same time, it is also different from the Chinese development. And so, you know, it, on the one hand, it has this, you know, democratic values and, you know, the value-oriented sort of, importance. On the other hand, it still is conducted through Asian means and Asian sort of approaches to things. And I think that is one thing that makes a majority of Central Asian countries it's easier for them to accept that kind of Japanese approach because they know it is an approach which is closer to what Central Asians are used to in terms of how to deal with these issues.
Bruce, you want to say something?
I just wanted to add one other point here, too, that from the Central Asian point of view, you need something plant or something built, and it requires advanced technology, and your choice is a Russian company, a Chinese company, or a Japanese company. Not to say anything bad about Russian and Chinese companies, but I think Japan has a much better reputation for technology. Mm-hmm. And so when you're going to build port facilities in Turkmenistan, compressor or processing plants, things like that, Japan might have a little bit of an edge. At least as far as the view from Central Asia.
Yeah, again, talking from the Central Asian perspective, when it comes to Western countries, investing in the region, democracy, rule of law, human rights has always been an issue in those dialogues and discussions. Should we expect this might be an issue with increasing Japanese investment in Central Asia, Jack?
Well, I think it's notable that, as we probably all saw, Human Rights Watch wrote an open letter to Japan ahead of Abe's visit, saying that he should raise human rights issues across the countries that he was visiting. And I'm pretty sure I didn't see any mention of human rights in any of the reports from any of his visits. So I think that tells you something. Whether it becomes a greater issue further down the line, I don't know. I'm not a Japanese specialist, and I couldn't tell you whether there might be problems for Japanese companies that wouldn't arise for, say, Chinese or Russian companies. I'm not sure.
I think it's worth
noting that it didn't seem like any human rights issues were raised on this trip.
Perhaps, Dr. Dadabayev, you might be in a better position to talk about this from the Japanese perspective, where we should expect to see the issues like human rights and democracy be on the Japanese agenda when it comes to Central Asia.
It is actually quite interesting that during the visit of in 2006, the Japanese prime minister was the first prime minister to visit Central Asia after Andijan events, among this, leaders of the so-called developed countries, And during that visit, Prime Minister Koizumi actually raised this issue of importance of following human rights and democracy, etc. And during this visit, Prime Minister Abe actually didn't refer to this notion of human rights and, the Western standards of, dealing with the various issues. And I think, that probably signifies a larger sort of shift in the Japanese approach to this particular region when before, this particular visit, Japan actually attempted to have a very dual approach. On the one hand, they emphasize this, the democracy and values and human rights. But on the other hand, they also, attempted to, look for the functionality of the cooperation. And this year, we actually see a move from that approach, and we see actually a complete and pure focus on practical issues and practical sort of areas of cooperation, without actually touching upon this notion of human rights and democracy. And I think that partly has to do with also with the notion of the Japanese view of democracy and human rights, because many Japanese, these views are very closely connected to the notion of human development and human security. And so Japanese actually emphasize that without economic progress and without a proper sort of development in terms of economic indicators, it would be very difficult for a particular country to, forego through the political reforms, etc. And they emphasize that it's important not to forget about the everyday life of people when we think about the notions of democracy and human rights. And I think, that probably is another aspect of why Prime Minister Abe didn't emphasize this point during this visit, because for him, economy and, the developmental projects are also part of this, human security, and that connects to human rights and democracy.
Right, right. Thank you very much, Dr. Dudabaev.
Yeah. I just wanted to mention that, that for what it's worth, Abiy didn't totally forget about some of this stuff because he did praise Kyrgyzstan for the elections that it just held earlier this month. So he didn't make it a big priority, but at least he made a point of saying in Kyrgyzstan that they did a good job holding elections.
Right, right. So our time is almost up, but I have one final question for each of you. So where do we see this relationship is going forward in upcoming a few years? Who wants to start? Jack?
Yeah, sure, I can start. I mean, I think there is a genuine opportunity here in that in an environment of falling energy prices, it makes sense for the energy-rich countries in the region to be investing more in the downstream, in processing and that kind of thing. And as Bruce said earlier, that's an area where Japanese companies are traditionally very strong. You can also see there's this huge investment in infrastructure in the region. That's another area where Japanese companies have traditionally been among world leaders. So there's a clear opportunity with the region's needs for investments and Japan's strengths fitting. I think the real question is going to be whether Japan can find the right method to work in what is a very difficult business environment in pretty much every country in the region, and where I think it's fair to say China has found a much more effective kind of strategy, which is much more direct. I mean, I spoke to a Kazakh businessman for the story that I wrote, who told me, you know, look, the Chinese come and they have one Chinese company pushing for some contract or some business or other, and that company is backed by Chinese bank lending at a very competitive rate, and it's guaranteed by the Chinese government. And the Japanese don't have that same kind of focused government-led approach, at least so far. So it will be a big question to see whether Japan can compete with other interested players in the region in that method of working in the region.
Right. Dr. Dudabaev, so where Japan wishes to be in the region in upcoming, let's say, 3 to 4, 5 years?
I think, you know, this is something that we all are trying to sort of figure out. And, you know, we obviously, for many reasons, we do not have a sort of obvious answer to this particular question. But, you know, I think what is important now is that, you know, we are at the stage when we have this, intent spoken out, but we don't actually have yet the, obvious and, you know, clearly defined way of how that is going to be delivered. And I think, you know, many of the agreements that, if you look at the language, you know, these are agreements on, further work towards certain goals. So, in other sort of words, you know, sides agreed to work on certain issues. And the, claims of large investments and, you know, large amounts, these are still, you know, the political intent as opposed to, the plan of actions towards this event. So I would probably argue that, you know, it really depends on how, the commitments which were, articulated, they're going to be, delivered. Because, you know, in previous years, we've seen many commitments on Japanese side on many issues. And, you know, some of these, commitments unfortunately didn't actually materialize for many reasons. And not necessarily, you know, the guilt only on the Japanese side. And so I would say it's a very good start, and I think, you know, these are very good sort of commitments, but we are still not quite sure about whether these particular commitments are going to materialize into something practical.
Bruce, final words from you.
I might agree with what both Jack and Timur have already said. Obviously there's a lot of factors that are going to play a role in how Japan operates in Central Asia in the next few years. Will the Chinese economy bounce back? Will Russia decide to put more political pressure on the Central Asian governments? Even outside Central Asia, what kind of opportunities will Japan see in other parts of the world? Or will they be locked out and decide that perhaps the focus is best put on Central Asia because they don't have the inroads in South America, Africa, places like that, where China has been working very diligently and where Russia is trying to spread too. So it really, there's a lot of things that we have to see. Japan certainly has a good reputation, and it has a proven history of sustained interest in Central Asia. So, you know, to their credit, that should work on their behalf if they do decide that they're going to commit to Central Asia more strongly than they have previously.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Bruce Panier, Central Asia specialist, and my colleague in Prague. And thank you very much, Jack Farchi, Financial Times reporter in Moscow, and Dr. Timur Dadabayev, lecturer at the University of Tsukuba of Japan. Thank you very much for the fascinating insight and for participating in the discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, director of the Turkmen Service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and all the team in Prague. Dear listeners, thank you very much for listening to the podcast. Bye-bye.